You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody, this is Dr. Michelle Cohen, and I welcome you, as I always do, to my couch, where I have the most fascinating guests, in all humility. But, I'm blessed to have people who come to me and share their research a lot on psychology, as you know, and also spirituality, if you are, and, quantum consciousness, things like that, where we can expand our minds and expand our lives and become basically better people. And so here we are once again with an amazing guest, and let's bring her on right now. There she is, Penelope Holt. Hi.
Hello, Michelle. We've got so much to get into. I don't even hardly know where to start.
I know, we do. And first of all, I want to thank you so much for being here, taking the time, because you're an amazing writer, as people will find out when we share a little bit later about some of your other books. But today we're talking about your latest book, which just came out. It's called The Angel Scroll. And here it is. Ha! I love it when I have the hard copy in my hand, because
I know it feels good, doesn't it? I like to read digital on Kindle, but there's nothing like the feel of a book.
No, exactly. So it's called actually The Angel Scroll, Prophecy, Destiny, and Love. Actually, just love. And that's what it's all about, right, Penelope? I just, there's so much going on about who you are and what you have done. And I love to get into the background of some of my guests, first of all, before we jump into the information about your book. But you were born and educated in England.
Yes.
Oh, I love it. And now you live in New York.
Yes.
You've been a playwright for a long time, novelist, marketing executive, and a prolific business writer. So can you roll out just a little bit more about some of your work as a novelist and marketing executive, all those things, so people can really get a good feel for who you are now?
Well, I grew up in the industrial north of England. Went to college in York, which is a very ancient Roman town. It's 2,000 years old. It was called Aboricum. It was the capital of the Romans when they invaded England in 55 BC. And it's a walled city. They kind of had to wall off the crazy Celts and, and in college, I studied literature and linguistics and really wanted to be a creative writer. But it's like winning the NBA lottery to really make it. But I had the opportunity in college to write plays and have them produced at Edinburgh Fringe Festival and York Arts Centre. And then when I moved to Manhattan, looking to make it big on Broadway like everybody else.
Right.
I think like $4 an hour at working as a playwright at the American Folk Theater. So I quickly got into business writing because I needed to make a living. Manhattan is expensive. And I like to say, if you want to be a writer, then you have to write every day. And if all you can write is press releases in the backs of ketchup bottles, then So I spent a lot of time writing speeches, co-authoring books, ghostwriting articles, editorial things. I had a family and, kids, a busy life.
My goodness, yes.
But when life started to settle down a little bit in the early aughts, as we say in England, the early 2000s, I got back into creative writing. I co-wrote a memoir with Alan Bailey, who was the founder of the Harlem Gospel Choir, and he was one of the people responsible for creating Martin Luther King Day on January 15th.
Wow.
I believe it's the first Monday of the second week of January.
Right.
And I've spoken about this before, but it bears repeating. He was such a lovely guy, very smiley, just one of those people that laughs at everything, very good.
Yes.
And he knew the greats. He worked with Michael Jackson, the Jackson 5.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. Yeah, Miles Davis, who lived on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, was apparently a very curmudgeon-y. I think he had some substance problems, but he liked having Alan around because Alan was such a smiley, feel-good. Yeah. And then Alan's friend, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was also from Harlem before he became a famous basketball player. So we sat and, you know, I interviewed him over 6 months. Like, you find it fascinating to get to know people. And, you know, we just rolled the tape recorder and he talked about, you know, Muhammad Ali and Nina Simone and all of these fascinating people and the civil rights era, you know, when they were marching on Washington, and he knew Percy, who was Malcolm X's lawyer. So he was involved in Harlem. And then he went on to form the Harlem Gospel Choir and, you know, took a lot of people with fantastic voices, you know, who otherwise may not have a shot, and took them on tour. They toured tirelessly all around the world. They actually toured in communist China as a Christian gospel choir. So I did that. Really loved that. Yeah. Fast forward, I did The Apple, which was based on the Holocaust memoir of Herman Rosenblatt. You know, he kind of mixed in a fabrication, a love story, with this true Holocaust, and wound up on Oprah. And it just, there was this big firestorm.
Yes, so, it was.
Yeah, that was a bit heavy. Yes. And then, you know, just more recently, I've done The Angel Scroll, which is kind of, in my own little imagination, is my magnum opus, as they say. It's sort of, you know, if you've got one book in you, this is the book that really, I think, expresses, because so much of it is about my journey as a spiritual seeker and using a character to kind of act that out for me and discover the things that I've discovered. In an exciting plot, touring around Europe, which, I mean, I've been around Europe and traveled, but I haven't been on a scavenger thriller mystery around the world.
Oh, that's cool. I love it. Well, I love this because right up my alley too, and in my interest in talking with you just briefly before we went live here, I am all excited about sharing with listeners and viewers, you know, about the story and how it sort of evolved. And also we can talk about your background of study in the spiritual and about Jesus and about the Essenes and about the Buddhism and about Hinduism, all the stuff that you can share in your book. There are some embellishments about, you know, the adventures that they go through. But so what were some of the things in your life and the studies and interests that inspired you to write this book?
Well, I went to a Catholic convent school, a grammar school, and it was run by nuns. And unlike some of the stories I hear about nuns, these were really beautiful people, very devoted, very. And I was very fascinated by that because they were living to sort of a higher ethical value. Sure. And we were, you know, we had November charities, which was all about helping other people. You spend the whole month of November. We would go on pilgrimages to Lourdes, you know, people who were seeking miracles and healing. So I was very steeped. We went to mass frequently, and it was a very uplifting experience. I really got a good grounding in spiritual, not dogma, but the liturgy of the mass, the beauty, the transcendence. So I, you know, that really sort of kind of grounded me in spirituality and religion. And then, you know, just as I traveled, I just began to look at, I got very into Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism, which I really liked because I like psychology.
Yes.
I think Buddhism does an amazing job of mind training and really helping you to understand how your mind works and how you can change, recondition your mind. So you don't, and the Buddha said, you know, don't believe anything on faith. There's no dogma. Do it for yourself. And if it doesn't work, throw it out. So I like that.
Yes.
And then I studied comparative religion, Hinduism. But like you, Dr. Michelle, what has piqued my interest is how science is now beginning to kind of intersect with spirituality. And, you know, anyone who hears me speak knows I rave about Bernardo Kastrup, who's this brilliant PhD. And he made a very, he said that, you know, during the, when the Vatican sort of controlled the world, they said to science, you know, at the stake, if you claim that the sun, the earth goes around the sun and that the sun doesn't go around the earth, we're going to burn you at the stake. So they said to science, you can live in the realm of the material and we will claim the realm of the soul. And I think that's how Bernardo describes the schism that you don't find in the East. You know, East tradition is much more integrated. But in the West, with the Western Enlightenment, we really separated out materialism from spirituality to the point that, Stephen C. Meyer, who's a great philosopher of science, says our scientific method does not entertain the supernatural. So you can study only what you can observe and measure. You can't take into account, is there a God? Because if you can't see a God and you can't feel a God and you can't prove a God with a scientific experiment, then you can't add into the equation. Yeah. So you sort of leaving like 99% of life out at that point. So I just, like you, I've just become very interested in how, not that we put so much faith in science and experts as we should, but it's very interesting to see these very well-educated scientists with a lot of intellectual rigor actually coming around and saying the hard problem of consciousness, you know, we don't understand consciousness. Everything we experience through consciousness is fundamental. Yes. And coming out and saying, you know, the fancy word is, analytic idealism, which means basically, it's a creation of consciousness. And that is, I think, all when you look at spirituality through that lens, it just starts to make a lot more sense.
It does. It sort of blends, I guess, and not the dogma, but religion per se with science. And I've heard you say something about nihilism is the path of transcendence, which I really thought that was very cool. So what do you sort of mean by that when you say that?
Well, I think what I was saying is that in the the latter belief in Western religion has gone down. I think only 40% of Europeans believe in God. Nietzsche famously said God is dead. That society had moved on, the Enlightenment, that we had rational, secular humanism. And I think you may have heard me say that the great atheists like Ayanna Hirsi-Ali and Douglas Murray are saying, whoops, we were very quick to ridicule religion, spirituality, believing that secular humanism, that people would find their own morality and they would make good decisions and they would be happy. And I think what we're finding, correlation is not causation, but we're seeing a lot of anxiety, a lot of depression, a lot of nihilism, a lot of despair. And I think that nihilism can be the path to transcendence because Ayanna Hirsi-Ali, who was a great atheist, just came out and converted to Christianity and said she saw all of these psychiatrists, she took all of this medication, and finally a therapist said to her, did you ever think that maybe you're spiritually bankrupt and that you're thirsting for God? And she started studying very humbly. And now she's coming out and debating Richard Dawkins, who's like the king of the atheists. He wrote The God Delusion, And she's coming out and she's saying, he thinks it's just, God is just superstitious nonsense. But Ayanna Hirsi-Ali is debating him and saying, we were wrong to belittle and ridicule this.
And that's beautiful.
I don't know how it works, she said, but it is that depression, that heaviness, that feeling of nihilism, that emptiness is lifted. I don't know how it works. And I think that's the point. I'm not sure any of us know how we work, but I think when you have a spiritual framework to cling on to, you have the fruits of that, which is hope, faith, optimism, right?
Yes, absolutely. Oh, beautifully said, Penelope, beautifully said. And I also think that, and we'll get into this in just a tad, your character, Claire, she lost her husband. And I think when we have trauma, as a psychologist, I've learned that a lot of people come to me who have had trauma, loss, cognitive dissonance. What? Wait, that's not the way life is supposed to be. It opens them up to the possibilities of other things in life, besides perhaps a dogmatic religion or perhaps nihilism, which is nothing No, everything is up. It opens them up to the possibilities because their brains are sort of trying to search for how to deal with this loss, how to deal with trauma, no matter what the trauma is, basically.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people become more awakened, and then they get to choose that path to go down further. Do you feel that?
I do. I mean, I think, you know, we live busy lives, and we're sort of, we're in a denial of death anyway. You know, as a psychologist, it's a survival mechanism. You know, the Stoics, the Stoics say memento mori, live with the memory of death, because it'll, you know, live with the death on your shoulder, because it will remind you to live well. But I think, you know, if you go through a loss that feels like an amputation, which Claire does, you have to grow spiritually. You have to, otherwise you just sort of shrink into despair. And so you've got to find a way of thinking, a way of acting, self-talk, exploration, finding, like, you've got to reach out into the world and find those things that are going to bring you the comfort, not in a hollow, delusional way, but in a true way. In you need to grow and expand, and in growing and expanding spiritually and emotionally, even though you're grieving and you're bereft, you will find, like you say, you'll find that your life is now sort of taking a different path. You're making different choices.
Sure.
You're thinking different thoughts. You're acting differently. You're understanding who you are, who your loved one was. And, you know, I think all of us, when we lose someone, you know, we say where.
Right.
When my sister died, my niece wrote, Mom, where are you? I want to find you and bring you home.
Oh.
And I think that's how people, they need to believe that they'll see, we'll see our loved ones again in some form, you know?
Yes, perhaps. Yes. And as you mentioned, there's so many books coming out, and of course you can get on YouTube and see some of these medical doctors, like Eben Alexander, right? Yeah. Who, of course, he's a neuroscientist.
Wasn't he a neurosurgeon or a neuroscientist? Yeah, right. I think he's an actual MD, a doctor.
Yeah. He is, hardcore medical doctor. Always believed in, you know, science, and that's it. What you can see is it. And then, of course, he had this tremendous out-of-body experience when he was clinically pronounced dead or brain dead or whatever, and shares that with the world. As you said, so many people have experienced that. But I think, you know, the whole thing is hanging on to what we have in this 3D. We hang on to the now and what we have. And of course, we want to hang on to our loved ones and our goodies in the material, whatever that is, you know, and really search and find out more. We're very thirsty to find out more. Most of us, I think, in life. And I think that is also, as you would say, going through the journey of looking within, not out. Going within and asking your higher self some of those questions and waiting. I was listening to an interview you did about how you would wait. I loved it, for the next chapter to come to you. You were waiting, you know.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you, do you think you were channeling this information for this book? Or?
Well, sometimes I hesitate because I don't want to overstate, you know, because some of these words or concepts become dangerous and they trigger people.
They do.
but I will tell you that in the process of writing the book, I didn't do any kind of an outline. I would literally write a chapter and not know what was going to happen next. And then I would think about it, and you know, it's not like it just, you know, appeared, but
yes,
I think I explained it as, it's almost like I was excavating it, you know, it's almost like it was rock with something in it. And I was just chipping away at the rock to try and uncover what was there. Right. And I did. Yeah. And I was led to do research and just nudged to do certain things and the way I put the story together. And I mean, you know, you could say that a lot of what we do is motivated in an unconscious level.
Yes.
And, you know, we sort of are aware of it unconsciously, and it comes into awareness. And it was, I would write until 4 a.m. and I had to get up for work the next day. But I would ache. I would get out of the chair and I'd be like,
oh, my God.
Right. But when it was coming in, it was just like, it's almost like Claire doing the painting, and the painting paints this, and it's almost like, remember the, it's a very old movie, The Red Shoes?
Yes.
The Ballard, who was that? Was it Morris Shearer? Yes. They put on the red shoes and they danced her to death almost. Red ballet shoes. So when it pours out of you, you just want to keep going. I think, who was the novelist that wrote Eat, Pray, Love? Elizabeth.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. A lot of writers believe in the muse, in like inspiration is like floating around and it's looking for someone. Yeah. You know, it's like, all right, can I meet the muse? Are gonna, and you have to grab it. You have to say, I'm open. Yeah. You know, it's like a deli counting. I'm open.
It's really true.
And a lot of good writers, very sensible. You're not, they're not being, you know, too sort of far out there. Do say that inspiration is real and it comes. Anyone who's been inspired to do something, that will tell you it's got a real feel to it. It's a real process. It's difficult to put into words, but it's a real thing.
Yes. And I think that's in keeping with the theory, as with Nassim Haramina's, you know, and many other consciousness so-called physicists, who talk about how we are all available and can be available to that field, such as the geniuses who created, my gosh, you know, Tesla and Einstein and all of the geniuses, Da Vinci, artists, scientists, whoever created anything out of pure genius was open to that field, which was bringing them information. They don't know where, from, why, whatever, but it just sort of, they're available for some reason to have those aha moments of those calculations, which help us all in our world and have advanced us, you know, from the Industrial Revolution into now and whatever, you know, and beyond. And so I think you're right. I think it is a little dicey to say, oh, I channeled the book. But I think if we're open to, of course, learning, and we have the background in our memory and we have a lot of information, but also when we're open to that, and wait and sort of go within and ask for information, sometimes it just comes and we don't know why, like you said. And when it's coming, you have to just go with the flow, right? You just keep writing. So
yeah. And I think that, you know, we're told you can walk, you can talk, you can drive, you can study, you can do this, you can do that. There are so many things, you know, whether you want to call it psychic ability, but
yeah.
I think I read once that the Zulus are quite telepathic because they have to travel over great distances. So I think there are the, you know, people do, you know, Tom Campbell, who famously worked with Rowe to do the, you know, the remote viewing and the telepathy, you know, the Inigo Swan's remote viewing, the government of Russia and America were training remote viewers. So the things that we sort of put into the category of science fiction or woo-woo, psychic ability. I just think in some instances, we're just not trained to be aware that that we can cultivate.
We are not.
We can cultivate. I've met psychics, mediums who are very down to earth and they tell you things. And, you know, part of you saying, oh, coincidence. You almost want it to be a coincidence because you can't quite put your head around how they're doing it. But, you know, imagine if we train children. You know, when my kids were little, we rode away to Princeton labs that used to do sort of very respectable psychic research.
Right, sure.
They would do toying cossets, you know, head or tails, which is it's always, if over time, it's always going to be 50-50,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
That's just a law of over time. Mm-hmm. And they would actually do mind over matter experiments where they would actually shift.
Yes.
Get people, and they came up with something called the mind lamp.
Wow.
And I don't know if you can still get this, Dr. Michelle, but you plug it in and it starts to change color. It goes from pink. And then you have to sit and you have to try and control what color it changes.
Mm-hmm.
Because there really is this principle,
yes,
obviously, of consciousnesses, right?
Yes.
We're kind of creating reality through consciousness. You should be able to manipulate reality.
Yes.
And so I'd sit there and I'd get my kids to do it. And see if you can change the color of the lamp. And, you know, after, and again, you think, oh, well, it's just a coincidence. I want it to be pink and it's going pink. And then I now want it to be green and it's going green. And you sort of get on this roll where the lamp is working with you. And it's a bit disorienting because you're thinking, oh, my goodness. And there's a particular feeling that you get when you do it, you know. I'm sure in your work, when you're talking to someone, you kind of go into a zone where you know, I'm in the zone with this person, we're connected now.
Right.
And you just get this feeling that, you're sort of playing with your mind to say, you know, what? How do I need to think? How do I need to focus to make this lamp change? So, I taught my kids that not to be foolish and gullible, but to just be a little more open to these paranormal, above normal, you know, alongside the normal.
That is so cool. No, it's so true. I think there was back in the late 70s, early 80s, when I lived in San Francisco, I hosted a talk show where I got to have anybody come on who I wanted. It was late night, one of those late nights. So, and you're in San Francisco, so everybody's cool. So, but I was able to interview Joseph Chilton Pierce, who wrote The Crack in the Cosmic Egg. And he talked about the Geller children, who it was an institute who was studying children such as yours, and they were teaching them.
Is that Uri Geller, Michelle?
It was named after Uri Geller and his work. And so Joseph Chilton Pierce talked about the children who were being raised to not have any negativity, to know that they had unlimited power in their minds, and that, you know, just allowing them to do is sort of like in that scene from The Matrix, right? Where the children.
There is no spoon.
Exactly. But he was talking about that back then in the late 70s and early 80s. And of course now, and I had various psychics who worked with the Bay, you know, North Bay Police Department, who would find missing people, much like Peter Kirkos. They would hold objects in their hands and pick up the energy from those people and find missing persons. So, I mean, it is a thing, and it is absolutely, you know, I do digress, but but yes, the mind over matter is a real thing, and I think a lot of the distractions we have, and a lot of the young folks who are so distracted by the social media and can't really focus and are looking at our world and are higher frequency beings in their DNA. And I think they're confused and anxious and depressed, and they're trying to figure it out and grasp onto what's real and rejecting a lot of the religious dogma they've been brought up with, and, you know, looking into a higher sense of purpose, I guess you might say. So
that's part of, you know, part of what I was doing in the book too. I think just reflecting that, you know, I grew up where mainstream religion was, people were still going to church and putting their Sunday best on, right? That grew up in with mainstream religion, and that has almost certainly gone away now. And so I think that people are looking for spirituality, but they're not going into the church. We lived next door to a little Salvation Army hut when I was a kid, and they'd see the ladies with their bonnets on and their tambourines singing, bringing in the corn.
Yes.
And I told my mom, I want to go there, because it looked just so, you know, with the outfits, you know, as a child, it was just really compelling. Yeah. So I don't think kids are sort of, you know, led into church anymore, or that sort of lifestyle. And they're looking. So I think that they are sampling different faith traditions, and it's a mishmash of spirituality and, you know, religion and, you know, new age things. And I think there's this patchwork quilt that they're trying to put together to say, you know, I want something. And what is the path? And in some ways that may be more confusing. In some ways it may be better. Sure. Because people wind up leaving their church, especially if it's fundamentalist, because they may like some of it, but they can't get on board with.
Yes.
A friend of mine once left the Catholic Church, and it was so comical because she had been quite a devout Catholic. And she said to me, "Pen, when they told me that I was supposed to eat fish on Fridays, and then all those years, and then they turned around and said I didn't have to eat fish on Fridays, I see, what else are they lying to me about? And it was sort of a silly comment, but she was saying, you've been so rigid and dogmatic about certain things.
Yeah.
We used to wear the St. Christopher's medal. Remember St. Christopher the patron?
Sure. Yes. Absolutely.
And then they sacked him. They sacked St. Christopher. And you're sort of saying, what, you know, her point was like, what, you've been insistent about these things and now you're changing your mind. So anyway, that's sort of an aside, but I think, you know, that young people, and of course, you know, there's a deficit of, and the detrimental aspect of social media. But I think the fact that somebody can tune in and listen to you, I mean, they can go around, you know, on the internet and really explore so many, many things that might touch them or just open them up. It's a brand new world. Yeah. And in the book, that's sort of what I wanted to do, because Claire was a Catholic and she prayed and prayed and prayed when her husband was dying, almost like a mantra. And then when he died, she said she was mad at God, like many people are, you know.
Yes.
And so now she meets a Buddhist monk and a Benedictine monk and a goddess worshipping, early goddess worship anthropologist. And so she's being given all of these different flavors of spirituality.
Yes.
And
so
reconcile it with her apparent supernatural experiences to say, what's happening to me? She's having visions, she's having dreams, she can see things. And she's saying, who wants to step forward and explain to me what's happening? These crazy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So beautiful. And let me just say this, that I do not put down religion because I think it really serves a beautiful purpose in all aspects.
Yeah.
I think if we can all agree on the concepts of love, kindness, you know, all of that Ten Commandment stuff. But I mean, and there's, and tradition and culture, family, you know, and I think this is all very important in certain religions, Judaism and Catholicism. But there are certain, I think, man-made things that have been created, you know, in the Old Testament, the Bible, et cetera, you know, not to take those things literally, of course, a lot of it. And it's been kind of retranslated into, you know, I don't know, perhaps helping people understand more law and order and keep their moral systems in place as well. So, but I just thought I'd throw that up there. But let's get into your book. So Claire Lucas is the woman who lost her husband. And of course, this opens up her awareness and she has these dreams and this one particular dream, I want you to get into that, which you were a little bit. And then she meets Richard Markson.
Right? Yep.
So they both embark on an enthralling spiritual journey through the ages. And can you share a little general story about some of their journeys that they go through?
Well, for people who remember, I can't believe it's over 20 years now, 25 years since it was published. But The Da Vinci Code, I thought, was a great book.
Perfect. Yes. Yeah.
Because it took a story and it really sort of wove in these fringe religious theories and beliefs. Opus Dei, which was real. The Roslin Chapel. Mary Magdalene, you know, all of these, I thought it was absolutely intriguing. And so, I sort of had that in the back of my mind that, so Claire dreams about a man who she thinks is Jesus, but he's in Varanasi, India, which is where the historical Buddha awakened. And he's in the deathbed of a beautiful young Indian woman. And her husband is begging this young holy man who's in a loincloth with a top knot, just very peacefully there watching this woman struggle. And he wants, the husband, of course, wants him to heal.
Sure.
But there's a connection between the woman and Jesus. She knows that she's dying and it's grace amid dying. And because what you infer is that he knows that there's something more, right? It's not the end, it's the beginning, as it were. So Claire has this vision and she's compelled to paint it. It's, her husband has just died. She's a middling artist and she channels this work. I mean, it's just coming through her. She's exhausted. It's coming through her, and it's a masterpiece. It's a modern, it's like an old master's masterpiece. It's just way beyond.
Wow.
So it's taken to a gallery, and it starts to heal people. It starts to have this effect. And then Richard Markson sees it. He's looking for these paintings. He comes to Claire and says, a new Dead Sea Scroll has been found, the Angel Scroll, and it predicts that three miraculous paintings will come together in the third millennium to heal a broken world. And we think yours is one of the other paintings, and we have to find the other two paintings and the scroll which has been stolen. And so now they go on this. But in the midst of, they go to Israel and Europe, Rome, France, Glastonbury Tor in England, which is a very sacred space. And then, so there's a lot of adventure in it. There's good versus evil. There's romance. But Claire is seeing visions through an almond shape, the vesica piscis of sacred geometry, right? That the eye shape.
Yes.
She's getting these visions through this. It's almost like a third eye, but in the wrong place. So she's she's grieving. She's caught up in this chase around Europe, and she's having these strange experiences. She's physically ill. Her doctor thinks she has an aneurysm, which may be causing the problems. So she's just trying to make sense of the day to day, and also make sense of this new spiritual emergency that she's in. So that's kind of the way that the plot goes.
So they're on their journey, and they come into contact with so many things.
Yeah.
A lot of this, again, has to do with your historical research that you've done, on Jesus and the Essenes. There was a time you went to India, right?
Mm-hmm.
Benares.
It's Benares now. It was called Benares back then, yeah.
Is this research that you have done for a long time to find out some of the missing information that has not been presented about Jesus, and not only that, but about Buddha and, his awakening under the Bodhi tree in that particular area. So is this a lot of research that you did in order to create this story of these adventures that Claire went through?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I had a lot of interest in this. Read all of this stuff and then sort of leaned on it. I was writing the book, it sort of gave me a lot of motivation. I wanted to weave in all of this stuff. I know you know about the Essenes, Michelle. The Essenes were separatists. They were, at the time of Jesus, it was the Pharisees, the Sadducees. The Pharisees were very strict about law, and the Sadducees were sort of more, I think, benevolent agnostics. But these scenes were influenced, it's alleged, through Moses, who was the child of Pharaoh. The adopted grandson of Pharaoh. Pharaoh's daughter adopted him from Moses. And so he knew a lot about the Egyptian mysteries. He was influenced by Egyptian religion, which in turn was influenced by Hinduism.
Yes.
And so it comes down through to these scenes that... It's written, you can do the research, it's not me making it up, that the Essenes were very much, they believed in reincarnation, they were absolutely against killing, they did not do sacrifice, animal sacrifice, they thought the temple was defiled, they would not worship there, they followed a solar calendar, they kept themselves separate out by the Dead Sea, hence you have the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls are believed to have been written primarily by the Essenes, and their old books of the old Bible and Mosaic law, and just lots of different, amazing finds. It was such a treasure trove. You've in the Bible, Jesus said, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And he revised a lot of that, forgive, turn the other cheek. How many times should I forgive my brother? 70 times, what did he say? 70 times seven. And he said, I leave you with two commandments, to love God and love one another. So it sounds pretty Eastern. There's an intersection. And I know some people get very upset when you say that. But I think it's important for people to know that at that period, three centuries before Christ, all of these religions that we are separate and distinct now, they were all cross-pollinating. They were all intersecting.
Yes, they were. Yes.
They have the same roots. So for me, it's just been fascinating to sort of follow it all back to see how what the, you know, the sort of mouth of the river is, and where you see these compatibilities.
Yes. No, I hear you. And I it's very interesting to see. They do cross-pollinate, a lot of them. And Muhammad and writing the book, which included, of course, the Old Testament and the New Testament. You know, so I mean, it's just everything. And of course, Eastern religion with the philosophies of the Essenes, which kind of, I don't know, I guess it came before the Essenes. Perhaps, we don't know. Maybe you know that. But Buddhism and Hinduism and those such religions.
I think the Buddha was 2,500 years before Christ and was said, I'm just a man. You know, there's that lovely story. It's probably apocryphal, but after he was awakened, he's walking down the street and he sees these. And he'd been in an ascetic himself. He'd starved himself. And, you know, he was looking for transcendence and enlightenment. He was starving himself and punishing himself. And then it's when he finally relaxed. He said, like a string of a lute, not too tight, not too loose. But he's awakened and he's sees his past lives. He understands, these pilgrims see him and say, "Are you a god? Are you, you know, what are you?" And he said, "I'm just a man." And they said, "What are you?" And he said, "I'm awake."
Ah. Wow, I love it. Yes.
And it's just, I'm enlightened. I see the light. I understand. And it's. I just think it's a lovely metaphor. And
it is beautiful. Yes.
They don't use the word God in Buddhism. You know, they really believe that the our nature is Dharma, is goodness, is compassion. Yeah. And it's just like a dirty glass. You know, our consciousness gets dirty, but perfect. The water is clear.
Yes, yes.
The clear light is there. We just kind of get muddied up with wrong thinking. And
Right. No, I think that's beautifully explained. So we're not going to have any spoiler alerts today on your book because I want people to pick it up.
Yeah.
Best way to get it anywhere, of course, on anything online. You can just find it. Here it is once again. Penelope Holt, my special guest today. The Angel's Scroll, Prophecy, Destiny, and Love. Ooh, it's a cool novel. Weaves you through a wonderful, exciting story. And also you kind of learn a lot. It's also thought-provoking because you'll start to perhaps, if you're really into this kind of learning journey, wait a minute, let me research the Essenes. Let me do a little more research on Buddhism and Hinduism. And, you know, let me... some of the holy places on the earth, are they really holy? Things like that. So if you're into this, folks, and I think a lot of my viewers and listeners are, this is what they crave, more information. And through this book, it's not just Penelope Holt doing an airy fairy, let's just create. This is based on a lot of research and takes Claire and Marcus through a lot of different adventures. So it's really cool. You've got to check it out. PenelopeHolt.com, H-O-L-T, PenelopeHolt.com. Now, I'm not wrapping up here too quickly because I want to, you know, ask a few more questions. We talked about, unless you want to share a little bit more about, you know, your book and getting a little closer to their discovery. If you don't want to do that, we won't do any spoilers.
No, but what I would say is that your list is probably my favorite kind of reader, because I've read books that have nudged me into explorations. And so I would really like for people to read it and say, oh, that's interesting. Let me go check that out and find out for myself. There is a book called Jesus in India. There's quite a lot of works that, you know, there's Tibetan manuscripts. And again, look, there's so many conflicting, scholars say definitely when in the last years, he, you know, the hidden years of Jesus between 12
and 12. Right.
What was he doing? Was he making tables and chairs as a carpenter, or was he touring India? And I don't know. I'm like the next person. I can only read and assess the credibility of the people who are saying the things that they say. But it is makes sense.
Yes,
it's a theory that makes sense. It's fascinating. There's some proof of it. It's been widely written. It's been studied. I did not know it at all until I started getting into it. So, you know, and then again, Glastonbury tour. You know, it's the story of Joseph of Arimathea who gave Jesus his tomb after he was crucified, and he took the chalice used at the Last Supper, had drops of the Christ. And he was sent to England by St. Philip to evangelize the Celts and the Druids. They were pagans, you know. And so he went and built the first Celtic Christian church. And he buried the Holy Grail, the chalice, in Glastonbury Tor. It was supposed to be life renewing, obviously, if you found it. And of course, that's where King Arthur, who's a real king, and his court. Right. Knights of the Round Table. We have all of this literature about the Grail Quest. So there's fiction in there, and it's intersecting with some facts. So I think I think people, if they dig into it themselves with YouTube and the books that are out there and the articles that are written, you can go down a really, really interesting rabbit hole if you'd like to.
Yes, exactly. You sure can. And it is really an inspiring, lovely book. And it really, it sort of gave me a lot of aha moments, you know, like that. Wait a minute. I learned about that, and this Penelope Holt is really into this. I love it. You know, it's really great. If there are just a few in the last couple of minutes that we have, few takeaways from your book, what would you like readers to get from that?
Well, something I wanted to, it's a question that Claire has, which means it's a question that I have. And I'd like to get your take on it. So, you know, I've quoted Donald Hoffman before. He's a cognitive scientist, and he's claiming that time and space don't exist. They're a construct, right? That he says that at the Planck scale, quantum 10 to the minus 35, space-time disappears, you know, the gravity, and it all disappears. You can't find atoms after that. It all just disappears. Sure. And there's a much more rich and complex explanation for that. And so you have this sense in which, and Eckhart Tolle talks about it, the power of now.
Yes.
So when people ask me, do I believe in reincarnation, I get a little bit stumped because this implies coming back again and again through space and time, different lifetimes, right? But then simultaneously, there's a belief that there is no time and space with God. Or consciousness, everything is now. But of course, our little human brains it blows our little human mind. And so Claire struggles with this because there is reincarnation in the book that she's simultaneously here, but she's simultaneously there. And so I wonder what you think about that, because we explain things and we explore things within the framework of space and time and past lives but at the same time, if we're existing in an eternal now, it's almost like we have access to everything all at once. And so I wondered, you know, that's something that she struggles with and she doesn't quite get an answer. It's something that I can't prove it, but I have a deep intuition about it. And I just wonder what you think about it.
I agree with you. I've always had a deep intuition about that. And I've worked with numerous hypnotherapists who are very good, and they've been studying many years. And you know, there's that Dolores Cannon, you know, who's written 20 books, but, you know, about regression therapy, and these things happen sometimes when you're regressing someone in psychology to their past trauma, and you're trying to help them and work with them. And then all of a sudden they start speaking another language. And you're saying, what? You know, they popped into another life, perhaps. You're guiding them back so far that things get out of hand. And I've read and heard a lot of information about this, the possibility of, we pop in and out of the time-space realm. When we leave this shield, this armor we have, perhaps we do have a soul that explores, because we're popping in and out. When we leave the body, of course, we're not in 3D any longer, so we become part of the photonic field.
Mm-hmm.
We come back for lessons, journeys, to better ourselves. What are we all about here? Why are we here? That kind of thing. So these are all mysteries to me as well that I've explored and interviewed so many people about. But that's kind of my take on it. I still have a big question mark, but I'm fascinated with, you know, that whole concept of why are people like Evan Alexander having these experiences, and Anita Morjani, and these really well-known people who are sharing these incredible adventures. And of course, the 20 books that Dolores Cannon has written, which are taken from transcripts of people who have gone into their past lives, and many of them have been documented as real people who existed. So where are they getting it from?
I just saw this child prodigy, 3 years old. I think he's 3 or 5, playing the piano like his tiny little hands with as a virtuoso. I mean, truly, like a concert, the most sophisticated. And you just say, no, it's there's what is he doing? Because it's just impossible. You know, my kids were coloring at 5. They were not playing Rahman enough.
Right, exactly.
But a question that I have, and maybe one of your future guests can answer it, who do past life regressions, is it that we have an individual soul journey, or is it we all have access to the same memories?
And that's the Akashic Records, perhaps.
Yes, I've got a friend who reads the Akashic Records. And is it that we can just access different lives, or is it that we've actually experienced them? Because then experience goes into time and space, right?
Sure, exactly.
Whereas can you just sort of shine a light into this life or that life?
Exactly.
I'm so sorry. Yeah.
We have a hard break coming up with the news. So I'm going to have to end here. Oh, my gosh. I could talk to you for hours.
The time flew.
Bonnie, you have created such a beautiful character, Claire, in your book and her journeys. And I thank you so much for sharing this again. It's a great book. It'll teach you a lot, takes you on a wonderful adventure, and will open up your mind.
Thank you, Michelle.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you so much for being here. You're awesome.
It's a great chat, a great visit. Thank you. I'm going to go put the kettle on now and make a cup of tea.
Sounds good.
All right.
Have a lovely day and evening.
You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right. So sorry we had to cut off Penelope so quickly. Thanks for joining me, Dr. Michelle, here on the couch. And I'll be back next week for you. Same time. Bye-bye.
You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.